Living Writers. Please enjoy.
Good afternoon. Thanks, as ever, to the excellent DJ Lamb Chops Hour, Jazz with Fava Beans, and a nice Chianti. Now you've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today Living Writers goes back into the archives to October 2010 in memoriam of Paul Auster's life. Paul Auster, born February 3rd, 1947, died April 30th, 2024. In this free-flowing conversation, as Paul Auster called it, you can probably hear how thrilled I was to be talking to one of my writing heroes. By the end, we do manage to talk about his novel Sunset Park, published in November of 2010. We talked over the phone, which at the time was very unusual for Living Writers. Thanks to Jason Voss for engineering way back when, and thanks to Tex for airing it long ago. I hope you enjoy today's conversation with Paul Auster in memoriam.
There ain't no sin in Cincinnati, since I've been in Cincinnati.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today you've got Paul Auster here with us from Brooklyn, New York, via phone. Paul, thanks so much for being on Living Writers today.
Happy to be there, even though I'm not there, but here.
Your disembodied voice.
Yes.
Which is what radio, at its heart, is all about.
True right? enough. True enough.
Well, thanks so much. And I should say, we're taping the show on 29th of October, 2010. And Paul, your latest novel is just out.
Almost.
Oh, it's still not on
the... Not till November 9th. I think that's the official date.
Oh, wow. So we're actually quite lucky to be getting to have a quick word with you before it comes out, too.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to say anything to anybody afterwards. This is the moment to do it.
You know, I was talking with emailing with James Meter, your publicist at Henry Holt Picador, and he was saying that you're talking with people in Brazil, all over this country, and internationally right now. So
yeah, it's been a busy time, I must say.
Are you taking honey for your throat?
No, I'm fine. I smoke cigars for my throat. That seems to help the best.
Much better. What was I thinking? Well, Paul, before we go any further, I'll just read your short bio from the back of Sunset Park, and then we'll go from there. How's that sound?
Whatever you like.
Okay, thank you. Okay, here we go. Paul Auster is the best-selling author of Invisible, Man in the Dark, The Book of Illusions, and the New York Trilogy, among many other works. In 2006, he was awarded the Prince of Asturias Prize for Literature and inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Among his other honors are the Independent Spirit Award for the screenplay of Smoke and the Prix Medicis Estranger for Leviathan. The French, you'll have to help me with, Paul, because actually...
Prix Medicis.
Prix Medicis.
Yes. Étranger. Yeah.
Thank you. He has also been shortlisted for the International IMPAC Dublin Literary Award for The Book of Illusions, the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction for The Music of Chance, and the Edgar Award for City of Glass. His work has been translated into 41 languages. He lives in Brooklyn, New York. Paul, thanks so much, not only for being here today, but also helping me with the French.
My pleasure.
And you are no stranger to French. It's so near and dear to your heart because after graduating from Columbia, you went to Paris.
That's true. And I lived there for about 3.5 years in France, 2.5 in Paris, 1 year in the country, where I was the caretaker of a farmhouse.
Have you ever been back to that farmhouse?
No, to tell you the truth, not since then. And that was 1973-4. It's a long time ago.
But the work that you did over there, the translating of French poetry, that's what you began to do when you got back to the States.
That was how I was writing poetry as a young person, and all through my 20s, that's what I did. And I published a number of books, and I was also translating French poets. But that's an act of love. But in order to earn my meager living, I was translating prose books as well. None of any great distinction, except one or two were interesting. There was a book by Sartre that I did, and I think there was a Simenon novel as well.
Your books of poems, let's see, there's Spokes, Facing the Music, White Spaces. These were all published in the States. I actually was hoping to read some of your poetry, and I found White Nights online.
Uh-huh. So good. All the poems have been, they're in print again, because Collected Poems was published a few years ago here in New York by Overlook Press. So everything I wanted to keep is in that volume, and all the work is from the 70s.
What was it like when you were going through and putting the collected together, Paul? What was it like revisiting those chunks of yourself from that time?
No, I don't know. I still feel very attached to that work that I did then. It may be the best stuff I ever did, in fact. Who knows?
The poems from those times. Why is it, because there's not any of the filters or the sort of a postmodern construction to it?
The poems are, I think they're, many people find them quite daunting and difficult. but it's simply that I did it. And then a moment came, I had a crisis, and I simply got stuck. And I went through about a year in which I didn't write anything, and felt that maybe I was finished as a writer. And then I got unblocked again, and it was prose. I was writing prose, and I've been writing prose ever since.
And that was the invention of solitude, what you were writing, wasn't it?
That's the first book, but I started writing some shorter prose things first.
Okay. And, you know, I think, I'm not sure, but maybe you had happened to talk about this in an interview with the Paris Review, perhaps that moment, that transitional time?
It's quite possible. I'm sure I must have mentioned it. It was a real turning point in my life.
And for a whole year, this feeling of wondering who you are, what the new identity might be.
Well, I was desperately broke at the time. My first marriage was falling to pieces.
And this was with the writer Lydia Davis,
yes,
Paul?
Yes. We were kids together, and we got married, but it didn't last that long. But we were really struggling back in those days.
And that's where your book, Hand to Mouth, those stories come from?
Yeah, that's my little book about money, or not having money.
Yes. I had the great luck to meet Lydia Davis when she came to Richard Hugo House in Seattle a couple of years ago. So I remember her fondly. A lot of your work is coincidence, Paul, isn't it? Like about us being alive, and if you're aware enough, you'll see connections with things or things out of your control completely. But this morning, I actually realized from your biography that you were born in Newark, New Jersey, and that which I sort of remembered, that you're a New Jersey boy, and then you moved to New York, and now you've become like this, like the key to the city is yours in New York City. But you grew up in South Orange.
Yes.
And my father actually did as well. And on our shelf at home, the bookshelf, there's the 1937 mirror of Columbia High School.
Oh, my goodness.
Of South Orange and Maplewood.
Yes. That's where I went to high school, Columbia High School, class of 65.
Oh, your class of 65. Okay.
Yes.
I'm writing this next. And so I just thought, this is exactly what Paul Auster is talking about. This is part of what you recognize in life and believe about it and write about, are these moments of, like just, and your, your quest for understanding and about your father and the idea of father, and then that my father actually went to the same high school.
Well, I have something interesting to tell you about that, because a few years ago, I was asked back to my old high school. I was inducted into the Columbia High School Hall of Fame.
Woohoo!
And so I got a list of other members, the previous people. One of them was Teresa Wright, the actress, who graduated from Columbia High School in 1938, which means that your father was in school with her. And Teresa Wright is someone who pops up prominently in this new novel that I'm publishing now, Sunset Park.
Yes.
For her role in The Best Years of Our Lives, a great film from 1946. So, see, everything connects.
Everything does. I'm a believer now, too, Paul Auster. That's incredible, because I think I was Myrna Loy. The name Myrna Loy overshadowed. I think that's what caught my attention, because she's also in Best Years.
Yes.
That's amazing. Well, we won't sing It's a Small World now.
No, we don't say things like that.
but you're so this is to add to the many awards that you've garnered throughout your career, now being part of the Hall of Fame at Columbia High School.
Yes, it's a great honor, and I'm really happy about it, to tell you the truth.
that is lovely. And so Paul, let's talk a little bit about Sunset Park, because the film, the Best Years of Our Lives, that is one of the threads that's woven throughout the entire novel, and it's interesting because it's talking about the return of World War II veterans, and the film is about that and how they're discovering their lives changed. And this seems to mirror your main character of Miles Heller within Sunset Park and what he's coping with.
Well, I think in a sense, there's a lot to be said about all this, but to begin with, Sunset Park is a book that takes place now. I mean, it is a book of the moment.
Yes.
Most of the action stretches from the fall of 2008 to the spring of 2009, so it's today, just as the economic crisis is hitting. But at the same time, it's about three different generations, really. The young people of today, and by young I mean people in their 20s, their late 20s, and then the generation of their parents, people roughly my age, 60-something, but also the parents of the parents, the grandparents, the World War II generation. So the film is partly about that earlier group, but we have quite a bit of information about Miles's father's mother and father as well.
Yes. And why was it important for you to span across so much time?
I can never answer why. I have no idea. I mean, these books that I write, they impose themselves on me, and I go where they take me, and this is where this one took me.
And was there a moment where you actually had to learn in your way of working that you had to trust that?
You have to. Otherwise, you can't write. You can't do it. You have to be very open to everything. Let your mind just wander, and it's like a magnet. You know, you pick up things as you go along, little filings from the past, from the present, even from the future sometimes. I think writing novels is one of the great emotional and intellectual adventures one can participate in. It ain't science, I'll tell you, and I really don't know what I'm doing most of the time on the deepest level. Yes, I know how to put a sentence together. I know what a paragraph is. I know how to tell a story. But why I'm doing it is a great mystery to me.
Well, you mentioned that also that it was a way back to writing, and it was also a way towards some bread and butter. So those. It seems like you are going. You're a man who would write, no matter what.
Well, certainly I've never written for money. Once I did. I mean, this period when I was stuck and didn't write any poems, couldn't write any poems. That was the year when I wrote a detective novel under another name, which I did in some very short period, I don't know, 2 months maybe.
Yes, Squeeze Play.
Squeeze Play, yes, by Paul Benjamin, my
your middle name.
Yeah. Yes. And that was the only time I ever tried to do it, and I wound up making a grand total of $900 for writing that book. So I can't say that it's a good idea to try to write for money. I don't even know how you'd go about it.
No. Well, it doesn't seem like you'd be able to be open, that one quality that you said that's what you have to be in order to see where it's going to go.
Yeah. Well, the thing that proved to me that I had to do this as a novelist was when I finished the first one, which is the first volume of the New York trilogy, City of Glass. That book was rejected by, I think it was 17 publishers.
Are you kidding?
I mean, it took a long, long time. And in the meantime, I was writing the second book. And I think I was into the third volume by the time the first one was published or had been accepted for publication. And it proved to me that I was going to write no matter what, even if I couldn't get published.
That also makes sense why they were so closely linked, because it came out, right? It was the City of Glass, was it 85, Paul?
Yeah, but it was written in 81, 82.
And it took that long to find its
yeah, I think
home.
The second was 83, and the third was 84, but the first one didn't come out till 85.
Oh, I love that story, and I think it also gives every writer out there a little bit of hope too. And when were you? So can you tell us when you were writing it, the Ghosts? Because if you said because the City of Glass is the first one,
yes,
and then Ghosts, and then the Locked Room,
right?
So were you also working a day job at that point, and then writing in the evenings, or how were you biding the time until the City of Glass, someone was finally brilliant enough to recognize it?
What was I doing? I was, I was still translating a bit, and I was teaching a bit as well. Not bringing in much money, but enough to breathe.
And were you teaching writing?
Yes, alas, I was.
Was that composition?
No, it was so-called creative writing.
Oh, well, that's great. The so-called, did you actually title your class that? So-called creative writing.
I don't
writing.
Know what the class was called. It was probably just called fiction writing or something like that.
And was it part of a, was it at a university, Paul?
Yes, it was at Long Island University, LIU, which is right here in Brooklyn. It's a kind of dumpy little impoverished college. With a lot of struggling immigrants who are very moving people. Really, I loved being with those kids. And then after that, the next year I got a job at Princeton, and I did that for about 5 years. So I was going back and forth between New York and Princeton a couple times a week. And then I stopped, and I haven't taught since. Gosh, the last time I taught was probably over 20 years ago.
And for that, do you miss it, or is it something where
No, I left as soon as I could.
That's what I thought from the beginning part of your, yes. We first started to talk about it. And you know, if you ever wanted to go and talk with classes, come on here to the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. I'd love you, come to my class, talk to
me. Well, I've done it. I've been out there. I don't know when it was. It must be about 15 years ago. But I did talk to some classes, and I had a very nice time. I enjoyed being there.
And maybe it's time. So maybe it is time to come back.
Maybe, you know, so.
Every 15 years or so.
Okay.
Well, Paul, you had also, let's take a short break, and then we'll come back and talk more with Paul Auster, who's speaking with us from Brooklyn, New York. Today we're talking about his latest, the novel soon to be released in November, Sunset Park. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
Today's Living Writers program was taped in 2010. Your regular host, T. Hetzel, will return live next week. Shake down the seams of my hands. Remember to snap the rubber bands.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today on the program, Paul Auster joins us from Brooklyn, New York. Paul, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's an honor, let me say that. So, Paul, were you able to hear the piece of the song that we played
yes,
during the break?
Yes, I could hear it. It's a demo that was done two or three years ago. Of a song that my daughter wrote and performed, Sophie Auster. And now that she's finished college, she's back in the groove and working very hard on getting a new album together.
So stay tuned for more music from Sophie Auster.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, well, lovely. Well, maybe later in the program we'll also... maybe we'll have a baseball anthem or something. So, because that's one I love how you say that you're open and to where things are going, the story, the characters are going to take you, Paul. And I notice though that there are as if you're a composer and this is your composition across a lifetime of words so far. There's the notes that you return to or at least that resurface. And one of those are including baseball moments, from American series or famous baseball players or baseball players who have, been hit in the eye with a baseball or...
Well, that's in the new book. As I was preparing to write Sunset Park, all kinds of things were happening in the world. Among them were the deaths of three baseball players, Herb Score, who was a great young pitcher for the Cleveland Indians in the 50s. He only had two seasons, splendid seasons, and then he was injured badly when a batted ball hit him in the eye, which ruined his career. He died in November, then of 08, and then in the spring of 09, Mark Fidrich was killed, the bird, from the Detroit Tigers, who had that wonderful season in 1976. He was only 54. He was working on a truck on his farm in Massachusetts. It collapsed on him, and he was crushed. And then finally, a very interesting character named Jack Lorkey, but who had the nickname of Lucky. So he was Lucky Lorkey, who... as I describe in the book, had three near-death experiences and walked out of each one of them unscathed. And so that's how he got his nickname. And he played on the Giants and the Phillies back in the early 50s. And so these three are part of the story. Some other pitchers as well.
And those are the main ones. And you use their stories to deepen the relationship between Miles and his father, Morris, as well, and how they, Paul, Morris is teaching young Miles how to play baseball, and he's quite good at it.
He learned from his father. You see, the grandfather was the great one,
And also injured.
Also injured. And then Morris, Miles' father, was never much of a player, but he teaches the young Miles, when he's a boy, the lessons that his own father had taught him, and Miles becomes quite a good pitcher when he's young.
And then when the tragedy that changes all their lives occurs, as soon after that, he doesn't think that he has the right to continue doing something he loves, the pitching.
Well, at least that's Morris's interpretation. Miles never says that.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
And which is interesting, because that brings us to another component of the book, where it's the multiple narrators, where you shift between the voices telling the story.
Well, actually, it's all written in the third person, so there's only one narrator, who's me.
Oh, okay,
it's
yes.
All the third person, but I shift points of view.
Yes.
So I move around from one character to another, and there are quite a few characters in the book of significance. And I know this is nothing revolutionary. I mean, novelists have been doing this forever, but it's the first time I've ever done that. So I found it very energizing and interesting.
And how did that happen? Was it some organic thing that occurred where you suddenly felt like the points of view that you...
Well, again, this is how the book came to me. I saw it as a book of fragments that all connect somehow. And so by moving from one to the other, giving different perspective on scenes, or even on the same scene from different points of view, it seemed to make the story richer for me.
Yes, and it reminded me, actually, and thank you for pointing out that it was indeed points of view. That's what I meant.
Yes, I know you did. You're a smart girl, I know that.
Oh, no, no. Very kind of you to say, with the dopey moments, for sure.
Join the club.
But it also, it reminded me, like, the different perspectives of, and I know this might be too much of a leap, and it might just be a coincidence of my own reading, but I was reading your New York trilogy back when I was first reading the Lawrence Durrell's The Quartet.
Uh-huh.
And so reading Sunset Park then reminded me how you only learned different aspects of what was happening, at least the reality for an individual character, much later on with Durrell's Quartet.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly with Sunset Park, that same feeling where you don't, that's the one way of showing that we don't, what we're trying to grapple with is to shape our own reality and be in it. But it's
funny that you should mention Durrell, because he and I corresponded late in his life. He was reading my books, and he liked them very much. He wrote me some beautiful letters that meant a lot to me, I have to say.
And when was that, Paul?
Oh, that was back in the 80s.
So that would be when you were really beginning fiction with fervor.
Well, that's true. But I mean, because of the length of the delay between writing and publishing, I had, you know, quite a few books were stacking up, so I published quite a few books rapidly, because after the trilogy, there was In the Country of Last Things and then Moon Palace, and all those books came out within about 4 years of one another. So those are the books that Durrell was reading.
And he was then much older then,
yes,
obviously.
Yes, he was an old man living in France, and I never met him, but we corresponded for a while. And then he got too ill to continue.
And there's something about a correspondence of letters that's very intimate in a different way, especially about ideas. Isn't it, Paul?
Well, I enjoy writing to people I care about. So, yes, it's a dying art, I suppose, letter writing, but I persist. And then, I guess, you know, thinking about multiple points of view, I take it back. I did it once before, but not in a novel, but in the film Smoke, which I don't know if you've seen it.
I have.
You have?
Yes,
well,
I've loved it.
We're bouncing from one to the other, and each section of the film has a title, the title of one of the characters.
Yes.
Which is similar to the way Sunset Park works. And, you know, I'm so stupid, I didn't even think of it until much later. When I had finished Sunset Park, oh, I had done something similar once before.
And I wonder if it was something about something in the story that made it the best, you know, those multiple perspectives, the best vehicle for the story. Because it has been a while since I've seen Smoke, Paul, so I...
Yeah, well, it came out, my God, it was 15 years ago now. So if your memory's a little dim, I know why.
I loved Blue in the Face, too.
Yes, that was the little companion movie we made right after.
With Harvey Keitel still, right?
Yes, he was in both of the films, yes. Yes, it was an improvised film, which we shot in 6 days. I can't believe we did that.
6 days?
Yes, I don't know how we did it. It's completely wild. I know there are people who loved it, and then there were people who hated it so much. I remember one of the reviews by that genius of film criticism, Rex Reed, said it was the worst film ever made, which I thought was kind of an honor, in a way.
Exactly. Then you know you've done something right.
Yes. I mean, the very worst. I mean, this is, you know, quite an accomplishment.
There's a little shout-out for Rex Reed there. how much of that was scripted, Paul? Because it seemed like a lot of fun somehow.
It was. I'll tell you how we did it. Because it's more fun to talk about movies than books. So
oh no,
I can tell you that we were filming Smoke, and by we I mean Wayne Wang and myself, and we were co-filmmakers on the first film, and. Wayne got the idea while we were rehearsing, actually before we started filming, while we were rehearsing with some of the actors to do improvisations. And some of the stuff that people were doing was so funny that Wayne had the idea, let's make another movie right after Smoke. We'll go back into the cigar store, which was our main set, mm-hmm. and turn on the cameras and see what happens. And it developed from there. And so I plotted out a number of situations, which I wrote out and gave to the actors. There was suggested dialogue that they could use or not use as they chose. And we originally had only 3 days to film. And so we did those first 3 days immediately after Smoke was done. I mean, we finished on a Friday, and then we started the next movie on Monday, which is, again, crazy. In the broiling July heat of New York City, it must have been 280 degrees out.
I remember people looked a bit warm, a bit sort
yes,
of sweaty, a bit.
It was excruciatingly hot. So we filmed those first 3 days, and then we put the movie aside, and we were concentrating on editing Smoke. But by, I don't know, mid to late October, we had some kind of rough cut, and we showed it to the producers, Miramax, Harvey Weinstein, and his brother Bob, and they liked it very much. But they said, boys, good job in 3 days, but think how much better it could be if you had 3 more days. So we said, yes, we agree, definitely. And I remember running out of the office and going home and writing 10 or 15 scenes in one day. I just sat and wrote, and then typed it all up, faxed it to everybody, and then we had to rebuild the cigar store. We had to hire new actors, do casting calls, and we had to get the whole thing going within 8 days because Harvey Keitel was leaving the country to act in another movie. And I've never worked so hard, so intently in all my life. And we managed to do it, and so, but we didn't film the second half until it was the last days of October. And we were lucky the weather held, and it was sunny, and it looked summer-like enough so that it would match up with the other parts of the film.
Yeah.
I remember we finished on Halloween, actually.
So right about now.
Yeah, right about now. It was 1994, so 16 years ago. And the beautiful thing about it was we were filming in this fake candy cigar store on a corner in Brooklyn, but it looked like a real place. And we had finished shooting the last scene. We opened the door, and it was evening, and all the kids in the neighborhood were walking around in their costumes. So we invited them in, and they took all the candy in the store for their Halloween treats. It was a wonderful, wonderful Brooklyn moment, I have to say.
And another wonderful moment of accident.
Yes, well, you know, things happen the way they happen, but that was particularly fortuitous, I think.
Yes, it's... Well, thank you. I wish we had some candy right now, Paul.
Well, you were drinking Coke before. Maybe you have a candy bar somewhere nearby.
Maybe, you're right. Actually, there is at the station. You are very astute. Now I see why you wrote the New York trilogy with the detective. Paul, it actually reminds me of also the nonfiction piece, because we were talking earlier about, you know, why write? And you actually titled a piece.
Yes, a little sequence of true stories. I did, I don't know, three or four little sequences of true stories. This was all in the 90s. And it came out as a little book from New Directions called The Red Notebook. And in a way, I think of those stories as my Ars Poetica.
Yes.
But without any theory, you see. I'm telling of my experience of the world through stories, and reader can draw his or her own conclusions. But
and that's the poet in you.
Well, it's just simply trying to demonstrate how unpredictable and strange life is.
And it does, I think. and sometimes there's Willie Mays makes a cameo at the end.
Yes, of that particular piece. Why write? That's true.
And that's the part where you say, you know, you were there. You waited for him after a game.
No, we weren't waiting. I was 8 years old. Let's get the context.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, so it was 1955 in New York at the Polo Grounds.
Ah, yes.
It was the first baseball game I had ever been taken to, major league game, and it was a night game, and the Polo Grounds had a very odd configuration, and the clubhouses for the players were not behind the dugouts as they are in all the other stadiums in the world, but they were in a little house in center field, in the wall in center field. And I remember we left the stadium by walking across the field and into the outfield, and there was a gate open under the clubhouse, and who should be standing there when we got there was Willie Mays in his street clothes. And he, of course, had become legendary the previous October for the famous catch in the 54 World Series.
Yes.
He was about 24 years old. He was just a baby. And I remember walking up to him and saying, Mr. Mays, I couldn't call him Willie. Mr. Mays, can I have your autograph, please? And he said, sure, kid, sure. You got a pencil? And I didn't have a pencil. And my father didn't have a pencil. My mother didn't have a pencil. And their friends didn't have a pencil. And Willie Mays looked at me and he said, well, sorry, kid. Ain't got no pencil. Can't give no autograph. And then he walked away. Oh, I was so disappointed. I can't tell you. So after that day, I started carrying a pencil around in my pocket, or a pen, which I still do now. And I jokingly finished the piece, I say that's how I explain to my children how I became a writer, because of Willie Mays. Now, there's a postscript to this story, if you want to hear it.
Yes.
Which I find very moving. One of the other pieces in The Red Notebook, I think it's another section called Accident Report. I wrote a story, it was actually something Wayne Wang had told me, about a friend of his, Amy Tan, the writer.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And so I wrote the story. I just called her A. I didn't give her name. And I've met Amy a few times over the years. We're not close friends, but, you know, warm acquaintances. And we wound up a couple of years ago at a writer's festival in Key West, Florida, wonderful place to go in the winter. And all of our books were for sale, all the writers there. And I realized I had never given Amy the story that I had written about her.
Oh.
So I bought the book, gave it to her. And she read it on the plane home to San Francisco. Well, it turns out that two of her very best friends are Willie Mays' next-door neighbors. And she called him up when she got home, and she said, go out and buy Paul's book. Go ring Willie's door. Go inside and read him the story. And they did it. And apparently, Willie Mays was so moved. He just sat there shaking his head with tears in his eyes, and he kept repeating over and over, 52 years ago, 52 years ago. And he signed a baseball for me, gave it to them, they gave it to Amy, and Amy gave it to me. So I have Willie Mays' autograph now, if you can believe it.
Paul Auster, I feel like that's amazing.
It was wonderful, just wonderful.
And how old were you? I was
60 years old.
Because you have
Amy
you
gave
been,
me the ball for my 60th birthday.
Because you had been 8 at the time. Oh, that's...
Yes. I mean, I didn't want Willie Mays' autograph anymore, of course, but I'm happy to have it. Just because it closes the story.
Oh, my gosh. Now, forgive me, but have you written that postscript?
No. I haven't gotten around to it.
Oh, that is amazing. I'm actually sort of a little, well, I'm taken aback there, Paul, with
good.
That. And yeah,
good. To leave a radio person speechless, this is good. We could turn the show into a John Cage piece.
You know, that's...
Silence.
That's so funny that you would... They're actually doing, in early November, a performance, I think it's Once, of John Cage's, like, some composition here. Funny that you say that.
Well, he's a really interesting guy and a wonderful writer. I don't know if you've read his books, but I thought they're...
Some of his poems I've read, or, as you know, the essays, the poems, those. Mm-hmm. But what do you love about them, Paul?
Well, you know, I haven't read it since I was about 19 years old, but there was a book called Silence, to use that word again. That was filled with his ideas about what he was doing and what he thought the world was like. And I remember finding it very, very engaging and intelligent.
And you read that when you were about 19?
Yeah, I think I was a freshman in college. Or maybe
I'm just writing it back down here. Well, Paul, also to... another story in the Red Notebook, was it literally... this is one of the more simplistic questions I'll be throwing your way, right? Was it really in a Red Notebook? Because I know you say you write in longhand.
I write in notebooks, and I happen to be using a Red Notebook. And that's why I called those pieces the Red Notebook, because they were literally written in a Red Notebook.
And were they more than those pieces, but you chose these to show, to put under the title, Why Write? It's True Stories.
There are four parts to this, the book called The Red Notebook, True Stories. The first sequence is called The Red Notebook, and then there is Why Write, and then there's
Accident Report,
and then there's another thing, another piece called It Don't Mean a Thing. You know, remember that song? It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. So that's the fourth piece.
Thank you for refreshing my memory there, Paul. I actually should know that. I wanted to mention that there was that number three, that section a little bit earlier, before year 8, you bring us to a time when you were 14.
Yes.
And this particular... your story is very... The others, while you were devastated as a child with Willie Mays and that transformed your life, this one transformed your life in a quite a different way, this story.
Yes, all the stories, the five stories in Why Write are all about children. I don't know if you noticed, but if you go back and look, you'll see they're all about children. Sometimes that child is myself, but not necessarily.
Yes.
But the middle piece, the longest of the five, and by far the most significant, is about that thing that happened when I was 14, which was, to be brief, taking a hike with about 20 other boys at a summer camp and getting caught in a very bad electrical storm. And the boy next to me was struck and killed by lightning. And I think if you experience something like that at that age, which is not infancy, obviously, but it's not adulthood either, you know, early adolescence, when you're so vulnerable to everything, it makes an everlasting impact on how you think about the world. And I think it was then that I learned that, yes, anything can happen at any time, and you never know what's going to happen next.
And you can be gone also, or something.
You snap your fingers, and it's life and then death that quick.
It's amazing how you construct the story too, because you begin by setting the moment of that transitional time when you're neither a child nor adult, and, mm-hmm. and that trying to and about identity, like who struggling with that.
Well, you really don't know who you are when you're 14. Aren't you trying on all different masks? I think, and then physically you're changing so rapidly. It's a bit perplexing. You look at yourself in the mirror and you're not who you were last week.
But it's still you. You're expected to still be you.
Yes, yes. You try to be you, but finally you don't really know who you are.
It's true. And that actually does keep happening as we get older, too. But at different, there's stretches of time. And sometimes I think we can't see who we really are sometimes because we have those layers of memories of who we think we are.
Well, it's devastating when you look at photographs, you see. That's when you really see the time marching on. And it's every once in a while, someone will have a glimpse. My wife's mother is 87 now. Once caught a glimpse of herself a few years ago in, I think, the window of a store, and she didn't know who it was, and then she paused and looked again, and then she said, oh, so that's what I look like now. Oh, now I see. I didn't understand until now.
Oh, because it's true, because, yes, I understand exactly, because we can't see ourselves until something allows us some one of the layers comes away.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. Some kind of objectification or surprise is needed in order to jolt you into becoming aware of what the real story is.
And we do that with those we love too, don't you think?
Yes. I mean, I've been married now to Siri Husted for 30 years. So she was in her mid-20s when we started living together. Now she's in her mid-50s. I still find her exquisitely beautiful, but she's certainly aged, just as I've aged. I can see pictures of us when we were first together and then what we look like now, and it's really apples and oranges. And yet, you know, we are who we were, just our bodies are falling apart.
And it's something about the eyes, too, isn't it? Because I think if you're looking in someone's eyes, those are very much the same energy in them, or so.
One would hope.
I don't know. Yeah.
One sees a lot of faces with the extinguished eyes of defeat and disappointment.
And yet, that's something that you write about, and you put your characters in, like, well, in these life situations and failure and. I don't, what am I trying to say here, Paul? It's incomprehensible even to me. But yet, you're also, I don't think you are ever trying to make it so that you definitely think they're okay, either. Like,
Well, listen, failure is really one of the most interesting subjects. Writing about or thinking about success is rather dull. Because we only find out who we are when we're really tested. And being tested, I mean, when your back is up against the wall in some way or another. And when you do fail, how you cope with that failure and go on from there. That's how you find out about yourself. If everything is going well, you really don't know. You expect it to go well. You become overly confident.
Yes, and maybe static in a way.
Perhaps, but anyway, I always have felt more kinship with people who struggle and get knocked around than the ones who somehow manage to escape. But finally, no one escapes. And life deals some rough blows to just about every human being who ever lives.
That's true, no matter what you can see on the surface.
That's right.
Paul, let's take a short break, and then we'll come right back. We won't be gone long. Today on Living Writers, Paul Auster, his book, Sunset Park. We'll be right back.
Don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Do I, 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 do I. Don't mean a thing. All you gotta do is swing. Do I, 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 do I. Makes no difference if that rhythm's sweet or high. Give that rhythm everything, everything you got. Don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Do I, 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 do I.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today Paul Auster is here joining us from Brooklyn. Paul, thanks again for being on the program.
Well, thanks for putting the song on. And who was singing?
Jason, can you answer
that? That was Ella Fitzgerald.
It was Ella Fitzgerald. Great. She did that song many times in many different versions. It was nice to hear her laughing, too, in the beginning.
And Jason Voss is engineering for us today, so thanks, and hats off to Jason Voss.
He acts quickly. I mean, we mentioned it only 5 minutes ago, and he already dug it up. That's good work.
He's razor sharp.
I believe it now.
Well, Paul, this has been a real pleasure talking with you, and I wanted to mention that there was a point in Sunset Park where I had a little bit of a laugh. I think it was with your character, Renzo, where I sort of thought, okay, I hope Paul Auster won't mind that we're doing an interview.
Oh, yes. Well,
can you fill everyone in what I'm talking about?
Morris Heller is his publisher, and Renzo Michelson is a novelist, and he doesn't do interviews, but he does one, and Morris is puzzled why. Because even Morris, the publisher, thinks interviews are useless, a debased form of literary activity. And, well, essentially they are. Although I've enjoyed talking to you today, I must say, because it's been a free-flowing conversation.
Not to put you on the spot, Paul.
No, but you see, most of the time now, if I do interviews, it's not because I really want to, but it's because I feel loyalty to my publishers. And I don't want to let them down. They're trying so hard, and it's so tough out there right now for everybody that they seem to think things like this can help push the books into people's hands a little more quickly or efficiently. And who am I to, argue with them about that?
But it is a big commitment, and I can understand why after the book is released, you won't be talking about it again for a while.
I hope not.
Or at least talking until the next book.
Right.
But I think that is a direct quote from the book, a debased form of literary communication, the interview.
Something like that, yes.
So, anyway. But also, earlier, when we first began speaking today, Paul, you were talking about when ideas and characters and pieces of the stories are coming to you, they're like little bit of their filings, some of them like things that you're seeing in the world. And then when you're writing them, the ideas present themselves to you. And you said sometimes even about the future.
Yes.
And so that seemed really curious to me. And I wondered, was there an element of that in Sunset Park with the pen writer, and please help me with the pronunciation. He won the
Lu Xiaobo. Yes, one of the characters in the novel. We haven't really talked about the novel. just to say that there's a group of four young people in their 20s who are squatting in a house, an abandoned house in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. It's a downtrodden neighborhood here, not far from where I live. And one of them, Alice Bergstrom, is a graduate student getting her PhD at Columbia. She's the one who's writing about the movie The Best Years of Our Lives in her dissertation, because she's writing about America immediately after World War II. But she has a job, a part-time job at the Penn American Center. And Penn is an organization I've been very connected to for years. I've been vice president, I've been secretary, and it's, you know, the only human rights organization in the world for writers. And the work that the Freedom to Write program does is, I think, essential.
Yes.
And one of the cases that Penn has taken on with great vigilance is the Lu Xiaobo case. And so I've known about this for a long time, and since it was happening just at the moment when the events in my book were happening, the arrest of Lu Xiaobo in late 2008 in December, it became part of the novel, because that's what Alice is doing when she goes to work. She's writing letters about Lu Xiaobo to other Penn centers around the world, and it's remarkable that he has won the Nobel Peace Prize now. I'm very glad, but at the same time, the Chinese have responded so harshly to this, with such petulance and narrow-mindedness.
What is happening to him right now, Paul?
Well, they have denounced the Norwegians who gave the prize. They've actually, I think, even cut off economic relations with them. And they've been bad-mouthing it to the world, saying, how dare you butt into our business? And his wife, who is apparently also an extraordinary human being, has been put under house arrest since the Nobel Prize. So it's not a good situation at all. And yet, having won the prize, I think they're not going to be able to do anything too drastic to him.
Because the world is watching.
Yes, we're definitely watching. And we're talking at Penn now about sending a delegation over to China to try to do something more about this.
I know in some ways I wish that we could make it into some sort of fantastic fiction where the delegation actually goes in and they extract them and bring them to safety. But then how many other people? Yes.
But you see, the point of Penn is you keep trying. You see, you're going to fail most of the time. This gets back to what we were talking about before. You fail, you fail, you fail. But you keep pushing. And every once in a while, something good happens. And we have gotten people out of jail. It has happened, and it does work. And the more pressure you put on, the better the chance of succeeding is. And so you have to keep going at it and going at it. And then finally, sometimes after years, you'll get the result you've been praying for.
Thank you, Paul Auster.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. This has just been a wonderful hour, and anytime you feel like a radio conversation, I'm your gal, okay?
Well, you sound like a great person. I'd love to meet you someday.
Oh, and meet you, Paul.
Okay.
Thanks.
Well, come to New York and see me.
Thanks so much. and it's time for your visit to Ann Arbor, right? It's been the 15 years. So.
Yeah, but when were you in New York last?
Oh, that you've caught me there.
Okay, so I'll be expecting to hear from you soon.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Take care.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye. And thanks to you all for listening to Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. This has been a conversation with Paul Auster, a day to remember, surely for me. And thanks again to Jason Voss for engineering. Until next time.
Don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Do I, 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 do I. Don't mean a thing. All you gotta do is
Now, from WCBN-FM Ann Arbor, an hour of programming randomly selected from our archive.